Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where our guest today is Gatti Al-Jabouri, the CEO and Chairman of Pembridge Resources. So hello, Gatti. Welcome on to the podcast. I know I've spoken to you before on an interview, but you're very welcome onto our Market Musings, more laid-back podcast. So how are you doing?
Excellent. Thank you. And really good to be talking again to you, Ken.
Excellent. Excellent. And Kenny, how are you?
Yep, all good. Great to have you on, Gatti. And I'm a bit jealous of your temperature. You said before we started recording that it was quite cold out in Dubai. It was only 24. I think we're at -4, -5 here, at least with the wind chill. So I'm extremely jealous, but you're welcome on the podcast, and we're interested to find out a lot more about you. And really, the way we structure this podcast, Gatti, is we like to sort of dig deeper into your background. It's almost like a potted history of Gatti, you know, where you were brought up, what your education was like, you know, your first job, maybe your worst job, you know, business successes, failures. Failures are great because everybody learns from failures. I mean, I've had plenty in my life, so, you know, it makes you a stronger person. So really, maybe for the next 10, 15 minutes, the floor is really yours, Gatti. Just tell us a bit about yourself and ultimately, know, the journey to Pembridge, and then we can talk about Pembridge perhaps later on in the podcast.
Perfect. Thanks, Ken. Well, I suppose I should start from the beginning, really. And I was born in Bulgaria. My parents are a Bulgarian mother and an Iraqi father who met at university in Bulgaria. And I was brought up mainly in Libya. A large part of my early life was growing up in Libya, where my parents were working. And an interesting fact is that I went to the largest American school outside of America, which at that time was in Tripoli, Libya. And the reason for that is because the Americans were the largest investors in the oil and gas sector of Libya. So they set up an oil school. Many people to this day say that I still have a bit of an American accent, which, to be honest with you, a little bit disappoints me, because I went to university in the UK, did my A-levels first in the UK, then went to university in Bristol. And by the time I had qualified as a chartered accountant with KPMG, I thought that accent should have gone away and it should be purely an English accent, if nothing else. But alas, no, many people still say that I still have a bit of an American accent. So at university, I studied civil engineering because as a son of an Arab, you have only two choices: medicine or engineering. My dad's a doctor, and he said, you're not becoming a doctor. So that left engineering. And actually, as a kid, really enjoyed drawing houses and designing buildings. So I always thought I'd become an architect. But when I found out that architecture is 6 years and civil engineering is only three, I said, yep, civil engineering is where I'm going. But all of this was happening while I was learning about university and the different career choices, still living outside of the UK, outside of Western Europe, for that matter. So when I showed up in the UK and started my A-levels, I all of a sudden, this is 1986, 87, I all of a sudden discovered this pink newspaper called the Financial Times. And the only reason, not because I'm a great economist or lover of economics, the only reason I started reading it is because that was the big boom in the stock market. And the family I was living with, that I was boarding with during my A-levels, were obviously watching the news every evening when I came back from school, from college. And the only thing they were showing was all these yuppies, stockbrokers with their huge mobile phones and driving their Porsches. And I thought, what the hell am I doing here? This is civil engineering? Nobody talks on the news about civil engineers. All they're talking about is people investing in stocks and shares. And this is a totally new world that I've never seen. So I called my dad and I said, you know what? There's a totally different world that you and I have never seen and don't know much about. And it's called economics, finance, and stock exchange, and shares, and bonds. So I want to study economics. Forget the civil engineering stuff. Well, he managed to convince me that I should stay and stick with it, with civil engineering. And even though every year of the 3 years at university, I would call him and say, I need to change. Somehow he managed to keep me on the straight and narrow. And I graduated as a civil engineer, which at the time I thought was the biggest waste of time because I just wanted to become a stockbroker and a finance guy. But today I am super grateful to him because having an engineering degree really sets your mind and sets your way of thinking and sets your approach to work in a very different way than people that just went straight to economics or accounting or finance, whatever. The problem-solving approach in engineering is actually really valuable. And I'm eternally grateful to him now that he pushed me and made me stay on. But nevertheless, once I graduated, having worked 2 summers as a junior site engineer on the Way Valley Bridge, which is the tiny little bridge which connects the Severn Bridge to Wales. And once I graduated, I told my dad, here's the degree. That's what you wanted. It's yours. Now I'm going to go and become a chartered accountant and start entering the finance world, the economics world. So KPMG offered me a job, having sponsored a conference that I'd organized with an organization called ISEC, a university organization for economic students that I was a member of. And lo and behold, I managed to get my qualifications and today I'm a fellow chartered accountant of the Institute of Chartered Accountants of England and Wales. And that was maybe the second big fortunate decision in my life. I'm talking about with respect to my career.
Yeah.
Because I think becoming a chartered accountant is one of the best things you can do as a qualification if you want to run your own business, if you want to be in business. Because accounting is not about bookkeeping. It's not about debits and credits. Sure, it covers debits and credits, but it's more about understanding the way businesses are organized, understanding the way businesses are controlled, and understanding the impact of tax on business, the impact of finance. I mean, it's a much, much wider perspective on economics, on business, than many people, in my opinion, believe it to be. To such an extent that my father, when I told him I'm going to become a chartered accountant, he almost had a heart attack. Because in the Arab world at the time, the kids that really were not very academically astute and capable became bookkeepers. And to him, chartered accountant was a bookkeeper. So I had to convince a friend of his who lives in London or who lived at that time for a very long time in London to go and see my dad and explain to him what exactly it is that I'm proposing to do. And when he came back to London, I said, so did you explain everything to my dad? He said, yep, absolutely. So you told him that this is a really good thing, that this is the right thing to do? He said, absolutely, yes. So he understood? Nope, he didn't. But he's okay, you can do it, because I told him that he should let you, but he still doesn't understand it. And I think to this day, my dad is extremely proud and happy that I went down this route. I'm not sure exactly how much he understands what chartered accountancy is, but he sees the results of my career having gone down that path. So he knows it was the right choice to make at the time.
Did you find, Getty, that being being an accountant really is an important part of running any business? Do you find that that's really helping you in your current role? I mean, we know another accountant, don't we, Kenny, quite well, Paul Johnson, the CEO of Power Metal Resources, who always sort of starts the interview saying, "I'm an accountant for my sins," and he came from that background. Do you feel it's really gives you a good grounding going forward?
You know, accountancy isn't the only route to learning how to read a balance sheet. It's not the only route to understanding finance. I think it's one of the better routes. And absolutely, it gives me the ability to evaluate projects in a way that I think I wouldn't be able to if I wasn't an accountant. Mm-hmm. It gives me the ability to evaluate potential partners and companies in terms of understanding the risks they're facing and identifying the risks they're facing and equally importantly, identifying how they're managing and controlling those risks in their business. So that basically creates a culture in you of looking at the bigger picture and not just what is the most obvious answer to the question. And I think that's something that is valuable for everybody that is in business.
So how did the career progress on from there?
So having joined KPMG, I honestly don't remember whether it was through choice or through luck. Mm. I joined a department which was covering oil and gas companies. I started from that point on being involved in auditing oil companies. Had a couple of small jobs on little pension funds and banks, but really, oil and gas was what I was concentrating on. So, for example, auditing Petrofina, which is now part of Total, and a few other companies that KPMG were auditors to. And that really sort of gave me the feeling that this is a sector that is interesting and that I want to be involved in. And one of my clients was a company called Lukoil, which at the time had just recently set up a trading subsidiary in London to trade all petroleum products that were being exported out of Russia. And I got to know their managing director. I was, by the time that I'd left London office in 1995, I was a senior on the audit and running it. So I had a lot of interactions with the management team at Lukoil. But in 1995, an opportunity came to go and head up KPMG's practice in Bulgaria, where I established the KPMG audit function in Bulgaria. And within 3 years, by 1998, it had become the largest audit practice in Bulgaria. And in fact, KPMG had indicated quite strongly that I was going to be partner in KPMG in 1998. By the time 1998 came along, they said, "Look, Gatti, you've done an amazing job, great job, but we still think you're a little bit young." I was 29 then. To become partner, we're going to make you a director. Stay as a director for a couple of years, and then you'll become a partner. And being young, being super ambitious, being very disappointed in believing that I was going to be made a partner, and then being told that I'll be only a director, I told the KPMG managing partner that, "You know what, I don't think I'm the right guy for you. I'm going to go back to KPMG in London, where I have my position, and I'll grow my develop my career in KPMG in the UK, which is a much bigger market. I'm not going to stick around, work really hard, and not get the recognition I believe I deserve. October 98, I went back to the UK because I had a 3-year secondment from the UK. So I went back to the UK and went back to the same department I was working in, with the intention, because my contract was going to be transferring over to a department which looks after M&A transactions. And the Lukoil managing director in London and his CFO, who is ex-KPMG as well, when they heard that I was back, called me in literally the day, the week before I was supposed to start back in London. And then they said, look, we're really fed up with you. We really don't like you auditing us. You ask too many difficult questions. We don't want you on our audit. I said, well, okay, no problem. We'll find somebody else if you really don't like me that much. And they said, no. We like you. We just don't want you to be our auditor. Come and work for us. So the day I went back to work in KPMG, the Russian financial crisis, this is 98, had hit. The Russian markets were falling. There were defaults. And I went to the partner that was responsible for me at KPMG and said, I'm resigning. I'm going to go to work for Lukoil. And he said, Gatti, I'm not going to even try and talk you out of it. You were crazy to go to a little country as Bulgaria when you had a great prospect here. Now you're going to a Russian oil company in the midst of the Russian financial crisis. This is so you that talking to you wouldn't make any sense, would it? I said, no, absolutely not. So on the first day back in the London office, I resigned. And a week later, I became the financial controller for Lukoil in London. And very quickly over time, became a finance director of the Lukoil trading arm that was in London. So that's how I got into the oil and gas sector, and that's my entry into Lukoil, which ultimately led to running the whole of the international trading arm of Lukoil, which by that time was based in Geneva, and responsible not only for petroleum products, but for oil and petroleum products. And by 2010, I was CEO. I was CFO from 2003 to 2005. And from 2005 to 2010, I really built up that business to a position of over 2 million barrels per day being traded by Litasco, Lukoil International Trading and Supply Company. And half of it was not Lukoil barrels. So it was third-party barrels being traded in over 80 different countries with offices in the US, Netherlands, Germany, Switzerland, obviously, Singapore, and China, and Dubai. But in 2010, the chairman of Lukoil, Mr. Alekperov, called and said, we have a project in Iraq and your father's Iraqi. I said, yes. You really need to go and work on that project now because we need people that can manage what is quite a difficult and very significant investment for our company. So in 2010, I moved to the upstream side of the business, no longer on the trading side, but to the upstream side, and started being responsible for the Iraq project of Lukoil, which was to develop the fifth largest oil field in the world called West Qurna 2, which today produces 400,000 barrels of oil per day. A project that we brought on budget by bringing it to production within 4 years, on time, and we spend $5.5 billion to bring it to that stage. And today it's continuing to develop, and ultimately that field will be producing in excess of 800,000 barrels of oil per day. So only half of the work, so to speak, has been done so far. And that to me is an amazing opportunity to have been part of such a significant material project, but significant not only for the company you're working for, but also for the country that you're working in, because it represents roughly about 15% of the oil production of Iraq, just under 15%. And it creates some difficulties as well. When you're used to dealing in billions, when you're used to talking to ministers and very high-placed CEOs, then you sort of have to pinch yourself and think, that's not real life always. So when I'm at Pembridge and I think, oh, I just need to call this person and arrange a meeting, I have to pinch myself and remember that I'm no longer part of a multi-billion international oil company where everybody picks up the phone and says hello and is happy to make time for you. I'm now working for what I feel is, together with my shareholders, my partners, our own business, which is a lot smaller. But at the same time, the CV that I have, the contacts that I have, still open a few more doors than if my CV was different. So in that sense, it's been a positive contribution to where we are now.
No, it was certainly a huge project, and obviously the size of the asset, and as you say, you were dealing with billions, and now at Pembridge you're dealing with millions. But it's good you've been to sort of both sides of the pendulum, so to speak. So how did the journey to Pembridge begin? What happened after Lukoil?
So basically, 8 years working in Iraq had its impact. It's a stressful job. It's not easy, to say the least. By 2017, I'd decided that this was going to happen sooner or later. But I'm not the kind of person that can sit back and just play golf and do nothing else. So I wanted to create a portfolio of non-executive directorships and quickly figured out that that's a lot harder than it sounds, in that to become a non-executive director, the easiest way for that to happen is if you are a non-executive director. So it's a bit of a vicious circle. And at that time, a colleague of mine, a friend, an acquaintance came to me and he said, listen, Gatti, we've got this shell company on the London Stock Exchange. We're raising some money and we're going to look for a project. Do you want to come and join us and put some money in? So I thought, well, this is going to be the most expensive non-executive director position acquisition. But I told him, yeah, I'll put some money in as long as you make me a non-executive director, which he agreed. So that's how in 2017, I put in a little bit of money into Pembridge Resources and became a non-executive director. By 2019, that person was successful in bringing together with another non-executive director on our company, the Minto Project. And together with the two private equity funds out of New York, Pembridge bought Minto. Unfortunately, there were some difficulties in the transaction, which he didn't manage to overcome, mainly related to raising more money, which Pembridge needed. And I told the directors that I would finance the company to the extent that it was the funds were needed. But because of my nature, I don't give money to other people to manage it for me. I manage all my investments by myself, just so that I know who to blame when I lose money, and I do lose money sometimes. And I said that for me to finance the business, you'd have to make me CEO and chairman. And because otherwise, Pembridge would have been in a very difficult financial position, I think it would have had to exit the project as an absolute minimum. They supported that. So in 2019, I took over running Pembridge with the expectation of a certain level of investment that I had committed to. And this is where all this great stuff I told you about my chartered accounting education, giving me the ability to understand everything and to forecast everything. Well, I forecasted one amount of financial support that Pembridge needed. It turned out to be a little bit more than that. But luckily enough, I was able to continue supporting financially Pembridge until this day. And today, Minto is listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange Venture Exchange, and we have a successful project.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a decent market cap. I think it's 200 million Canadian from memory. And obviously, you guys are one of the biggest shareholders on the register?
Yep. We have 11.2% of that company, which is over £11 million valuation for our share, for our company, which currently is trading at just under £5 million. So we're seriously undervalued, but it's my job to make that clear to the market, to current and future shareholders. And that's why I think that to achieve that, the best thing to do is to find a new project for Pembridge.
You guys are particularly focused on sort of, you know, advanced projects that have either got a resource or they're developing or they're near production. That's the sort of key part of the strategy.
Correct. And I'm identifying now Pembridge not as a copper mining company, but as a company that will invest in the energy transition sector. And copper is part of the energy transition. That's my understanding, my belief, and that's what I'm saying to my shareholders. So we could be investing in more copper, but we're very much actively looking at renewable energy, and in particular solar parks, which I believe are quite an interesting proposition, both in terms of size of projects, in terms of risk of projects, and also in terms of attractiveness for new investors.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about solar parks, because Scotland was kind of one of the sort of first sort of countries in Europe to really go mainstream with the wind farms. And there was obviously a lot of outcry, but nowadays people just accept them, and they're everywhere in Scotland, whether onshore or offshore, and nobody bats an eyelid now. They just accept it, and I think solar parks will be the same. You know, people will just accept it's a necessary part of life. If we want to, you know, keep living the same lifestyle, and the population of the world has grown, we've got to supply the energy needs, and it's got to be renewable, because the, as you know, and Martin knows as well, the, you know, these commodities we're taking out of the ground, they're not going to last forever. So we've got to get smarter and more efficient, and renewables definitely the way to go. But of course, that still needs a ton of commodities to make it happen. So it's a perfect fit for your strategy.
And to be honest with you, it's not so much that the commodities will not be there. It is this true requirement. It's not just a good wish. It is a real requirement to limit temperature growth in the world. And the only way we can do that is through renewables. We can't continue burning coal, oil, gas, etc. the solar panel not only generates electricity, but it can generate heat to heat your swimming pool, to heat your hot water tank in the house. Or if you are in warmer climates, it can also be used to cool your home. And these kinds of new applications of solar panels are really going to make a huge difference of going forward.
Yeah, and what kind of jurisdictions is it likely we're likely to see solar parks, you know, taking off? Obviously, I'm not saying Scotland's not an ideal candidate. There's never any sun here, but there must be jurisdictions in the world that are just perfect for solar parks.
You know, an interesting thing that I've also learned on this road of understanding the potential. I said, well, obviously it must be the Middle East. There's so much sunshine here. This is the place to be. Well, that's not actually that obvious, because the Middle East is so hot and warm for a large part of the year. The efficiency of the solar panels dramatically reduces because of the heat. So a very interesting geographical location that has been mentioned as one of the ideal locations is places like Nova Scotia in Canada. Mm. It has sufficient amount of sunshine, but it's cool. So you can have solar panels that generate more power in a location that has less sunshine than the Middle East, for example. But because the temperatures, the average temperatures throughout the year are significantly lower, the efficiency of the panels is that much higher to compensate for the fewer hours of sunshine.
No, it's an interesting strategy, and I'm keen to see how it develops over the next 3 or 4 months.
I'm very much hoping. I don't have anything specific on the table today. Lots of discussions, lots of ideas being thrown around with potential partners. But I sincerely hope that this year we will be able to find a project in this area, which yes, can move Pembridge into its next stage of development, and that is growing its portfolio of projects. But the size is not the key. I want to find a project with the right people, with the right experience, that will help us to get the next project after that, irrespective of what the size is. If it's a big one, 10, 20, 50 million, why not? There's a lot of bank financing available for projects like this as well. But the key thing that I have said is it needs to be relatively close to production cash generation. It needs to have a life in excess of 7 years, and it has to have an internal rate of return of above 12 million. Ideally, an NPV above 30 million US dollars, so that it makes an impact on our company. But that last KPI is more of a wish for KPI, because we won't stop doing a project if it's slightly smaller or if it's slightly bigger. But the economic KPIs, the return, cash generation being relatively close, those are things that we will definitely be adhering to.
Excellent. Excellent. Mark, I'm sorry, I've been talking too much as usual. Are you able to jump in with any questions for Gatti?
What about, could you perhaps tell us if there's a criteria that you're looking for, or certain conditions that potential projects have to meet for them to be sort of, you know, considered a compelling consideration for you and shareholders?
I really would like to continue our investment in the copper mining sector if the right project comes along. I will not turn down gold projects, as long as gold projects have an all-in sustaining cost of below $800 per ounce. And like I said, they have at least 7 years life of mine and an IRR of 12%. For renewable energies, I'd like to see at least 10, 20, if not even more megawatts solar parks that are either close to being fully permitted or fully permitted, meaning that installation of the panels and connection to the grid would not be more than 12 to 18 months.
Okay.
So these are the kinds of projects that I'm looking at.
Okay. And what's your opinion on the mining sector at the moment, but really going forward for the next 10 years? Do you believe in a super cycle, or do you believe other commodities will outperform, such as battery or EV green economy type projects will fare better?
You know, that's a really difficult question to answer. It depends on what people understand by super cycle for commodities. Am I bullish on commodities? I am bullish on commodities, but for me, bullish means that we are at levels, prices, which are unlikely prices to fall significantly below these levels. So the potential is more, and the risk is more on the upside than on the downside. So if you call that a super cycle, then it's a super cycle. I think that there are certain commodities that have, that I understand better, and I think have compelling proposition for investment, and copper is one of them. The statistic that I always like repeating is simple. Your normally aspirated car has 25 kilograms of copper. Any Tesla or any electric car, for that matter, has anything between 80 and 90 kilograms. So 3 to 4 times more copper. And with the huge expansion of electric car production, that's a large growing sector for copper demand. We're still recovering from the pandemic. Countries have significant investment, state investment projects in infrastructure. There isn't a single infrastructure project that doesn't require copper. So copper, in my opinion, has a very bright future, whether that means, like some people are saying, we're going to see $50,000 a ton by 23, 24. I'm not that optimistic, but are we going to see below $8,000 a ton? I'm quite confident that those days are long gone and we're not going to see that. In terms of other battery minerals, I think that all battery minerals today seem to have a bright future. I don't know what will happen tomorrow when new battery technology comes along and something new comes for storing power that doesn't use the same elements that are being talked about today. So I see, in that sense, a little bit more conservatism. I'm a conservative person by nature anyway. So I like to invest pretty much in sure things rather than what is just the most, the sexiest sector that people are looking at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm equally optimistic on oil and gas. There's been a significant underinvestment in the oil sector in the last 17 years. And the impact of that underinvestment is being felt today as we speak, which is why today the price is above $90 per barrel for Brent. And I think that we're not going to see a dramatic fall in oil prices. I'm not a big bull saying that we're going to see 120, as some people like Goldman Sachs have been saying, but I'm seeing I'm expecting a steady state, potentially a slow growth in commodity prices over the next 10 years.
Okay. Well, that's good news for any mining and commodity investors out there. I would echo that feeling. It's overdue, I think, as well. Well, thank you very much, Gatti. I mean, that covers everything, I think, doesn't it? It'd be nice to get you on again. you know, as and when appropriate, when you've acquired some projects, and we can talk maybe in a bit more detail about them. But to get an idea of your background and what's led you to Pembridge, and of course, what you're looking to do, I think we've pretty much covered that. Would you agree, Kenny?
No, that's an impressive CV, and I would invest in you now that I know your story and what you've achieved in your life. So it's a big plus, big tick in the box. But I appreciate the time today, and as Mark says, it'd be great to have you back on in the near future when you've got some news to share with investors.
Appreciate it very much, guys. It was a pleasure to talk with both of you, Mark, Ken.
That's
great. Certainly, as soon as I have a project, we will get together and talk in more detail about it.
Perfect. Excellent. That's great.
Thank you very much, Getty.
Great.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Ben and Russell. Tune in next time.